fashions, but in Buddy's eyes. I'm young, I'm beautiful. Ducky, and time goes flying, and I'm so lucky, I feel like crying.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Monday, August 13th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening, we have Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Michael is a writer and a photographer. You can see his writing and his photography at BroadwayStars.com. You can see his photography at FallSpotPhoto.com. Michael also writes for outlets such as Arts America and NPR. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
Also with us is Peter Felicia. Peter is a writer. You could read his writing at Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, at Critcherland on Fridays, and on the MTI blog throughout the month. Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
We are joining you on a Monday evening. We didn't do our Sunday morning broadcast because we have a special guest with us, the one, the only, Bruce Kimmel from Critcherland, who is a much-requested person. Many of our listeners have asked us to get him on time and time again, and we finally were able to. So, Bruce, good evening. Thank you for joining us from the West Coast.
It's my pleasure, and nice to talk to you fellows.
So tell us, is Follies really sold out?
Nah.
Yes.
Really? You don't have a couple dozen stuffing under your
I
mattress?
I do. I always hold back emergency copies, which I sell as I know that all the copies have arrived. We keep them back in case there are lost in the mail or damaged copies. So I sell those, but I will give you an exclusive if you like.
Okay.
Which is, we are going to do a second edition.
Well, I was going to ask that. Was this more successful than you anticipated?
Yes, because you never know because all the guys who were all of our classic show collectors are dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, many of them are dead. So
sure.
They don't buy
Not
TV.
All, but most.
That's true. And we'll all be joining them, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I was originally going to do 1,000, and I was worried, and then I figured, well, it's Follies. So we did 1,500, and that was fine, and it took 5 weeks for those to move, so I felt it was the right number, and, I haven't gotten that many emails since from disgruntled people who missed out, and so I felt it was the right number, but what's happened is, I did this once before with Promises, where I felt doing a second edition of 1,000 would be a good thing for the world. And this specifically is happening because Mr. Sondheim kind of wants it available.
Great.
Well, what Stephen wants.
Nah.
Yeah, I mean, I just felt, and it's good to have it, and it means, we're kind of evolving how this remix, what my involvement in this remix, how that's going to work, mm-hmm. In future years, that's evolving now because it's somewhat proprietary because I paid for it.
So
this protects the mix for another 3 years, and I felt that was very important.
Well, that's great.
All right. Now, you mentioned that most of us are dead, and I won't argue with that.
Well, especially you, Peter.
Is anyone as old as I? Anyway, the question becomes, you must have heard from a number of young people who wanted this, though, too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because this is one that even the young people want to know more about. They've heard endlessly, those of us who saw this first production, talk about it and reference it, and anytime there's any revival, we're always saying how it's never nearly as good as the original, blah, blah, blah. So I imagine, I know this not particularly a way that you would know this, but did you get the impression that indeed young people were writing in? Could you tell from like infantile handwriting or something that young people were writing in?
No, I know it because it's been on Broadway World, which is a board that skews very young.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, and not that I read it, very often. But what happened was, I think they've heard so much through the years that despite the performances being definitive on the album, that it was just a terrible out-sounding album. And they tend, and young folks tend to want the recordings of what they saw. And but what happened is, as soon as the word started getting out, they really started ordering. And it's the ones who had heard it and not liked it and never wanted to hear it again. It's, you know, the word they keep using is revelation or revelatory. And, you know, it's kind of what Sondheim said when he heard it, he called it a miracle.
And, oh, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, I what I did was compare them side by side. And the original does sound like two Dixie cups and a string. You
know, it was astonishing. When I got the first pass of the first number, our new mix, and I played it immediately next to the old one. And not only did it sound like crap, it sounded like there was tape bauble. It sounded very weird. But what people, you know, should understand with this is that this is the first time, despite the new mix, which is really helpful, it's the first time that you've ever had the first generation.
Right.
You know, from the 8-track master to the half-inch tapes, because everything else has been from quarter-inch generation away.
I would suggest, by the way, Peter, I don't know how, I would suggest to you and to everyone, if you didn't listen to them both through headphones, I would highly suggest that, because that tends to make it even more obvious how superior it is.
Wow.
So, Bruce, tell us about the process. I mean, how does it work? How do you improve on something that... you know, is it just different technology that was being used, or?
No, it has to do with one thing. For over the years, the party line, even in Ted Chapin's book, has been that it was a very badly engineered album. You know, everybody was tense. They were doing a lot of music in one day. Nobody liked that they had cut all that stuff. And it's always been blamed on the engineer or engineering. And you know what? You hear the result. And it's good engineering. It's really actually great engineering.
Huh.
And I just had an email 5 minutes before this phone call from Jonathan Tunick, who said, thank you for exonerating Bob Arnold after all these years.
Oh, that's great.
So what the problem was with the original LP is they mixed it in a day, and not even a long day, I don't think. But if you do the math of 17 tracks, even if it was a 16-hour day, you're talking about a half hour a song.
Yeah.
And they have to move on, no matter what. So you had all of those weird blends where brass would just suddenly overtake everything and just kill you, and the vocals over on the right and on the left and making no sense for whole verses of songs, and covering up that part of the orchestration because your ear can't hear when the voice is on the right. And the orchestration is on the right. So the engineering was really good. What was bad was the mix. And so I approached it. You know, it took a year to do this, to get it to where I could do it. And then when I finally got the Pro Tools session of the original things, it went very quickly. We did it in 3 days. But we took our time, and I'm a notorious nitpicker and a perfectionist about the mixes, and we just really took our time. But it all, the way they recorded, even though by that time shows were using 16-track tape, this was done on 8-track because it was done in a hall that was not a recording studio. So they brought in a remote unit, and they didn't have 16-track remote units in 71.
Am I correct that it was Manhattan Center?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're only dealing with 8-tracks. That was my first nervousness, is what can we really do with 8-tracks, because the bass and the drums are on 1-track, all the reeds are mixed together on 1-track, all the brass is on 1-track, the vocals. You know, we had a certain amount of control, but once I heard that first mix and I finessed it, I knew we were home free because it was just so beautiful. It was so clear, and every line of those brilliant orchestrations and making the vocals sound like you wished they'd always sounded, you know, like they're present and in front of you. And, you know, you can't have better performances than that. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, mm-hmm. people who've done this show forever, mm-hmm. since you cannot top it was the right cast in the right show with, and the right creative team at the right time.
Well, especially the right time because, you know, I mean, as we all know,
they went around much longer.
Yeah, Follies is very much tied to a very specific time because of the ages of the performers relative to the, you know, to the history of show business. And so in for no other reason than that alone, there, you know, the original cast had a authenticity that no other cast could ever have, you know, especially as the years went on.
And you know what's so funny is, you know, back then, and I saw the show here at the Schubert in L.A. right after it finished its run. And what's so funny is we all went to that show because we were all young then. And we all went to that show and thought, God, those people are old.
I know, yeah.
And
when
of
you
course,
see their ages,
you know, 20,
now, yeah.
20 years younger than I
yeah,
am now.
Yeah, 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 I know. That's
they were all, not that I'm 70, but they no, were all but, in their late 40s, you know, and I'm 64.
Sure.
And, so, but yeah. it was you had creative people who knew what the show was about. That's the key to me.
Right.
In why that cast is so good. Everybody knew what that show was about. Every revival that I have seen, all the actors play the end of the show at the beginning of the show.
That's a big mistake.
you know, in other words, they know where they're ending up. It's what in actor babble they call playing results.
Yeah.
And so they come on and they're weepy at the beginning and they're full of angst. And the great thing about that original production is you discovered it as you went along. You didn't know that at the top, that
sure.
Sally was, you know,
sure,
insane.
That's very true. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Now, when you pick up the tapes, the 8-track tapes, is there any part of you that thinks you're going to find even another measure of music, let alone a song or two or an extra lyric?
In the case of this, first of all, Capitol, we don't pick up the tapes. They transfer it to a Pro Tools session.
Okay.
But I saw the box labeling, and I knew right away it was the edited. What they used to do in those days was they would record on 16-track, if they record on 16-track, which they didn't with this, but if they did, like Promises, they would mix down to 8 tracks and edit that so that the 8-track, which then they would mix down to 2-track, the album master, the 8-track tapes would be edited. All the slates would be off, no extra takes, no nothing.
Mm-hmm.
With this, it was 8 tracks. They edited the 8-track session tapes. So I believe they threw out any additional takes, anything they didn't use, and even the slates. And I know that to be true now because when we finished, I realized we didn't have one more kiss.
Uh-huh.
And it was missing, and I go, oh, my God, I can't use that awful thing from the original CD because that was some rough mix they did back in the day.
Uh-huh.
And that was my opinion anyway because it couldn't have been worse. And it, you know, it was the last thing they recorded. And so I called Capitol, and I said, please do one more search. We're missing this song. It's got to be somewhere. And it took them about 5 hours, and they had filed it under soundtracks.
The ultimate insult.
And it was one little box of 8-track tape. So they transferred that, and what I heard on that is that was never edited. Mm. So that one, I got to hear the banter of the very tired and snippy Dick Jones producer, and I got to hear the 2 aborted takes. And I got to hear the take that was the good take and the pickup for the take that was the good take, which we had to edit.
Well, that answers the question I was about to ask, because I don't know if anyone even remembers, but the first time that Follies appeared on CD, if I recall, they did not add back One More Kiss. And
that's
and so I just assumed that it hadn't been recorded, and then they did when in the, you know, and the, I guess the second CD edition of it. So I suppose that's for the reasons you're saying.
And that's, of course, the reason we all assume that there's more stuff out there. You know,
yeah,
of course,
I
believe you, of course, and I'm sure you're right about that. But the problem when you get something like that after the fact is you start thinking, wow,
oh, of course,
there must be so much else.
Was the first thing I was hopeful of, is that at least maybe there were alternate takes or something that we could put on as bonus material. But there was not one piece of tape anywhere.
All right, the first time you approached anybody on this, did you find people enthusiastic? Did you find people saying, oh, God, this is going to be a wild goose chase. Oh, my God, go away, will you please? Or, oh, sounds good to us. What level of enthusiasm did you get?
It wasn't enthusiasm. The question was, I went to them, and I had been licensing a lot of soundtracks from them. And I had done Promises and Sugar. And I think we improved both of those albums.
Sure.
And so I started thinking, what album would I kill to do that to? And I said, well, the worst album ever done, Follies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the album that is not the album any Follies fan would have wanted.
Sure.
And so I called my guy at Capitol, and I said, would you ever consider, even though it's never been out of print, licensing me Follies for a limited run, and then it's yours again, and you can keep yours in print, I don't care. But I said the condition would be that you find the 8-track tapes, the multi-tracks, and I can remix it, because I didn't think remastering would help. And he said, yeah, let me look into it. And then 6 months went by, and I said had the same conversation. He said, yeah, let me look into it, very slow as these things are. And then about 3 months ago, we were chatting, and I said, what about Follies? And he said, yeah, I got the contract. So I think, yes, let's do it.
Well, that's interesting because, yeah, it does seem like it that once it got started, it seemed like, you know, from my point of view, that it all happened quite quickly. In fact, about 2 months ago, I was mentioning this, or even less, to Harvey Evans, and he hadn't even heard a word about it at that point. But now he, of course, has by now, and he wanted me to pass along to you that, you know, he's just thrilled with it, and he especially he said he considers it a tribute to Dorothy Collins because she, you know, along with everyone else, sounds so much better.
She is somebody I can't say enough about. You know, that was maybe one of the five greatest performances I've ever seen in the theater.
Yeah.
In the musical theater, anyway. I mean, just brilliant. She should have won the Tony with Alexis.
That would have been nice, yeah.
So, but it happened. It did happen. Once we got the go-ahead, it took another, like, month and a half for them to actually get me the inventory of the tapes. Once I saw that the 8-tracks were there, I said, please, let's go. Go make them right now. And took another week to get them, and then we mixed it in 3 or 4 days, all told, and announced it. They are always Capitol shocked by my speed.
Uh-huh. Are you allowed to tell us if there's anything else you have your eye on?
I have asked for 2 other shows. That I felt, well, one of them to me is, I can't tell you the titles, but one of them is, to me, literally the worst sounding cast album I've ever heard in my life.
Mm-hmm. These are not necessarily Capitol?
They are Capitol both.
Oh, okay.
So maybe if you put your thinking cap on, you'll figure it out. But, so one of them is terrible. And the other one is not terrible, but I wanted to do but it's not great, and it suffers a lot from that vocals way off the right, vocals way on the left, you know, for no reason.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do a test if they'll approve it.
I'm sure one of them is Funny Girl, but that's just
Well, it could be. But I wanted to do a test with a recording that had been done on 3-track, which all of those 50s and 60s albums, you know, late 50s, early 60s albums. So you don't have any play at all. You don't have much control at all. You have half the orchestra on the left, half the orchestra on the right, and vocals. But you can certainly fix the panning, and you can certainly fix the tinny sound, you know, which is, to me, abrasive. And I always hear from people, but if you don't have the Angel Broadway version, it's so much better. And then I buy them if I don't have them, and I listen to them back-to-back, and they're the same. They're not much better. So I want to, whether it's Funny Girl or whatever it ends up being, I'm going to do a test on one of the 3-tracks, and the other show was a later show. So
it's funny. I remember when I got my first cassette recorder that I decided to do a bunch of tapes where I would have one song from each musical chronologically, starting with Oklahoma and going all the way through. And I was amazed that every time a Capitol selection came on, how the sound was markedly inferior to both the Columbia and the RCAs.
Yeah.
There was a profound difference.
If you want to
there.
Talk about a catalog, I would love to get my hands on. I would love to get my hands on nothing at Columbia because I think they're all great.
Mm-hmm.
But I would love to get my hands on a couple of RCA albums.
Yeah, they have some. They have some bad ones too. But you're right. I mean, I agree with both of you. I think Columbia, generally speaking, was just really.
It's unbelievable. You listen to not Mr. Shepherd's Misbegotten remix. But you listen to Goddard Lieberson's Gypsy today.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the original CD release of that album.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. Yeah. It's breathtaking. They don't record better today.
God, I remember in the days when the ads used to be in the Sunday Times, the first time you'd see them, and I would look immediately to see original cast album by and hoping it was going to be Columbia, always.
Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. You listen to Subways Are for Sleeping. I don't know any better albums than that. Mm. It just sounds breathtaking.
Well, yeah. You know, with some of these, Bruce, if you get into, I mean, since we happen to mention Funny Girl, I know for a fact that's one of the cases where the mono album had some different takes on it.
Sure.
So, that's what I have heard.
Yeah.
Yeah. She specifically says, "We're going home."
In Cornette
Man.
Cornette Man.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So
I have heard that.
If that were to ever happen, I would, of course, include that stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 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 Do you have any idea, by the way?
You know, say what?
This is a different question entirely, but it's never made any sense to me why Barbra Streisand, this star of Columbia Records, selling a ton of albums, and Capitol gets the cast album rights to that show. Did Columbia actually pass on that show? Did Goddard Lieberson say, no, I don't think that we want this Barbra Streisand starring musical? It's never made sense to me that wound up on Capitol.
It's interesting because the soundtrack ended up on Columbia.
Sure.
Right.
And I think maybe Capitol was an investor. I think maybe it was a Ray Stark thing.
That's the only thing I can think of.
You know, yep. I once read a book that had all of this in it, Peter, and I can't even remember what the book was. It was either a history of Capitol or Columbia Records. I think it was Columbia.
And what was the answer?
I can't remember exactly, but it just had to do with sort of like politics. I wish I would even have the beginnings of an idea of where to start to look for that. But it was very fascinating. But I do remember that some people at Columbia felt very embarrassed.
Sure.
Especially because Streisand had already...
Absolutely.
Several solo albums on Columbia.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sure. Probably three, at least two. I mean, but I would think it was even three by that point. Mm. You know, and they were all very good sellers.
Not to mention the cast album of I Can Get It For You Wholesale.
Sure.
Right.
Sure. Sure.
So, Bruce, tell us about how this process goes forward. In the future, you said that they can maintain their release of Follies. Won't there be confusion among among consumers now? Because how did you differentiate your CD from the Columbia their CD?
We used the non-credits version of the art, and it says newly remixed and remastered. That's the difference in the packaging. But it's, again, what my position is regarding the new mix is evolving, and they're very, very good to me at Capitol. They really like me, and they're very much on my side, so I'm sure it'll all work out nicely. But in the meantime, for 3 years, I don't have to worry.
Hey, does Capitol have, well, what about something like Streets of New York? I guess if we're all dead, you're going to sell 19 copies of that. But, I mean, like, that never really happened, did it, Streets of New York? I think that was recorded
it's
by Capitol, right?
It's on CD now.
Yeah, that's right. It has been. In
but
fact, I have one.
Mounting.
Yeah, well, you can't have everything. All right. What about Curly McDimple? Do you remember that show? I think that was recorded by Capitol. Does that sound right to you?
I don't remember. It never came out, right?
Right. I think Capitol recorded it. I mean, the show ran 2 years. Doesn't mean a thing today. Don't misunderstand me. But but nevertheless, I'm pretty sure Capitol recorded that. So
I'll tell you a funny Streets of New York story.
I'm ready.
Because I'm, you know, you and me are the ones who know that show.
Sure.
But, and I can sing you the songs from it right now without having heard it in 40 years or 50 years or whatever.
That's fine. I'll do it too, but you do the harmony. Anyway, go on.
But in 62, was it?
Three, I think. But anyway, go on.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. My family had moved into a new house, and we got this newfangled thing called pay TV.
Wow.
Where we had a little box on top of the TV, and
did
you put in your
really?
Dollar, and you could watch pay TV.
Wow.
And one of the things I watched five times, much to my parents' chagrin, because I used their money, was Streets of New York.
I never knew that was broadcast on pay TV.
They broadcast it. I would love to see it again. Roll
Isn't that
kill,
something?
All those people.
Wow.
And one of the duo piano players was Lanny Myers, who I
really?
Ended up with, oh. Who did 50 albums for.
Yeah.
Sure. Isn't that something? I never knew that. I knew Showgirl was done that way.
Yeah, I've seen Showgirl.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. All right, that's something for all of us to look for then.
Yes, eBay.
You've given us another challenge, looking for Streets of New York. Isn't that something? So even though you didn't think it was very good, you watched it five times, huh?
I loved it. I thought it was great, actually.
Oh, okay, because you a second ago didn't come down to say the album you thought was so good. So is it you have
the
heard
album
the album?
Sounds terrible.
It does, yeah, yeah. So it's too bad. Those guys have potential anyway.
Bruce, let's step back from Follies right now and your current and future projects, and let's talk about, just give us some rough numbers here. How many albums have you produced?
Well, somewhere a little over 180 original albums that I've produced from, you know, that I would
from
consider
scratch, yeah.
producing, because mm-hmm. I take that word seriously. And on top of that, probably another 300 reissues.
All right, what have you learned about producing? What mistakes do you no longer make and haven't made for a long time that you used to make at the beginning?
I don't know if I would categorize anything as a mistake, but I did learn at the beginning what I liked in sound. And, you know, of course, I have spent a lot of my career in various careers of mine trying to do things I loved as a kid. So that's why I did the jazz versions of shows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why I did these concept things. That's why I did anything, you know. And so I learned to be patient.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big lesson for me because I am the most impatient person in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that you just have to know what you like. It was a huge lesson for me that you can't try to please 100 different people because they're all going to want you to please them in different ways.
Sure.
So you have to do what pleases you and what you respond to and hope that people come along for the ride. That was my huge lesson.
All right, given that Hollywood movies are more popular than Broadway shows around the nation, of course, do you sell a substantially greater number of soundtrack albums than you of these movie scores than Broadway cast albums?
It's complicated because the soundtracks have a very sort of loyal audience, you know, where I can count on selling at least, you know, of the 1,000, I normally do 800, you know, on any title. The show people, there are no show stores anymore. You know, it's Footlight and now Dress Circle went away, so they're going to be online. But I don't sell, you know, 100 copies to them both of anything.
I see.
But the big difference is, you know, 600 of a soundtrack will go to one or two or three dealers. And I don't get, you know, I get 30% less on those albums. Shows like Follies, I sold 900 of them the first day. And all of that money is coming to me. They all came to the site. And when they got to the site, a lot of people, you know, a lot of that 900 had never been to Kritzerland before. And they saw, oh, Follies, oh, Showgirl, oh, you know, the ones that were still in print. And they bought them. So we got a lot of multiple orders. So, you know, show collectors, you know, there's still 1,000 of us. Crazy people who really want everything. And sometimes reaching that 1,000 is slow going. You know, like we've certainly reached 600 or 700 for Carnival and 600 or 700 for the London Camelot. You know, Promises went right away, 3 or 4 weeks. This went right away. And, but, you know, everybody wants me to do Time for Singing. And, you know, I would have done it 3 years ago. I had a contract sitting in my house for Time for Singing 3 years ago. But it was, they wouldn't do it for less than 3,000 units. And I kept doing the math and thinking, well, how much money do I want to lose on this?
All right. Well, now, I wonder if some of the attrition has something to do with the fact that if I wrote a musical in the next hour and recorded it in the next hour, it could be out there. I mean, everybody has a CD now of his show. And the fact is, there used to be a time when if you had an album, there was an implication that you were at least somewhat good and somewhat professional. When those three labels especially. I mean, yeah, it's, when we started hearing the Pretty Bell was going to be on Metro Media Records and Buck White on Steady, you know, and things like that. We were starting to realize that things were devolving a little. But has that hurt, the fact that there have been so many essentially amateur musicals put out on cast albums? Has that diminished the product tremendously, that people are wary of buying cast albums because they've got too many dogs in their collection that said original cast album on them?
I think so. I mean, I think it's happened not only with that, but with singers. You know, when we started doing this in 1993, nobody was doing anything at that point. You know, Columbia was doing a very small amount of cast albums. Nobody was doing singers except for people like Patti LuPone and Betty Buckley and Barbara Cook. And, you know, RCA was doing three or two cast albums a year. And we sort of came out swinging, as you may remember. And, you know, within 3 or 4 years, everybody was back in the game. And suddenly, at the end of the 90s, we started seeing every singer who sang anywhere did their own CD. They didn't have a producer. They didn't put any thought. And the whole impetus behind having a CD was so they could sell it at their gig.
Well, I have a related... I have a related question. Am I correct that these cast album remixes and reissues are not available as downloads?
No, they are not. We never get those rights.
Oh, is it a rights issue? I thought maybe it was because of partly because you wanted the best sound quality possible.
No, it's but that for me it would be part of that. But they do not ever on a reissue give digital rights.
Oh, interesting.
Well, so, on the other hand, they can't put this out, at least right now, as we're evolving, they cannot put this out digitally.
So, Bruce,
you've had, you know, 150 or so albums that you put your title producer on, and another couple of hundred of other projects that you've been a shepherd behind those things. But it's far from the whole Bruce Kimmel story. I mean, you also have written movies, and you've acted, and you've written books, and you've done so many wonderful things. And I think you teach skydiving as well, don't you?
Yes. Jews are especially good at skydiving.
So, you know, how come you're on the West Coast?
Well, I was born here. I'm comfortable here. You know, in the heyday of doing the albums in the 90s, I was in New York every 2 weeks. And it got to be really old for me very quickly, being away from home. This is just my home. Know it is. It's hurt me in terms of not being, you know, when this whole sort of business model of how cast albums are done changed in 2003 or four. I guess it was three. And, I was kind of there because I was the first person the Schuberts wanted to record Amour at the Michelle Legrand show.
Mm-hmm.
And Todd Ellison, who was the musical director who I'd worked with a lot, came to me and said, would you be interested in recording it? I think I can get you in here and they'll pay for it. I said, yeah, of course I'm interested if they'll pay for it. And I flew to New York with a budget. But one of them, one of the people at the Schuberts, was a good friend of Kurt Deutsch at Schickaboom.
Mm-hmm.
And they had done a budget that was much higher than my budget, because I know how to do these things and I don't spend unnecessary time mixing for a month and a half. I don't understand how to do that. So it was cheaper by about $75,000. And they loved my budget, but this person who knew Kurt really wanted it to be with Kurt, so they handed him my budget, and they did it for my budget.
Wow.
And, you know, my real problem was I hadn't started Kritzerland, and I was still hinky from what had happened at Finsworth Alley, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And had I started and had I done that project, I would have gotten everything. But because I wasn't there and I wasn't sort of back in it yet, it all started going to PS Classics and Schickaboom. And now they're comfortable with those people.
All right. Now, how does a California boy discover Broadway to begin with then? What happened?
The way most people who are not in New York do, you know, my parents had the obligatory cast albums.
Mm-hmm.
The ones, even though they didn't love them, everybody had to have My Fair Lady, and everybody had to have South Pacific.
Yeah, it showed Kittredge that you were a middle-class home, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, we had them on 78s to begin with. And I listened to them because they were there. You know, we had Danny Kaye albums, and we had Betty Hutton, and we had these things. And then I became fascinated by them. And I started making my parents buy anything that I heard of. And in, I guess it was 59 or 60, I joined the Columbia Record Club and got my first Columbia House stereophonic record player.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would get every month a show album. And that's how I discovered it. I didn't actually get to New York until 1966. I think it was 66 or something.
Yeah, 66, yeah. You might have come in 67, but it opened in 66.
So my Aunt Minnie and Uncle Rube had gotten me tickets to see I Do, I Do, and we got in too late, and I missed it.
Oh.
And we were only there for one night. I still have the ticket. And so I didn't actually see a show on Broadway till I moved to New York in 1969. And the first night I arrived, I saw the all-black Hello, Dolly.
Mm-hmm.
And the second night, I saw Promises, Promises.
All right. Now, but in California, had you been going to the theater?
So The first show I ever saw on stage was at, ironically, I had never left California until I was 12. And my parents made me leave because they didn't want me in the house for a while. And I was taken to St. Louis by friends of theirs. And while in St. Louis, I was taken to the Muni to see Rosalie. And again, I can sing you that title song without having heard it since that night.
Yeah.
That Rosalie, my darling, is that it?
Yes.
Is that close?
Damn
so,
close. Good for you.
And I loved it, whatever it was. You know, I don't even remember where we sat. It was tiny, you know, so we must have been far back. And then when I got back to LA, I was hooked. I was bitten. So I saw Molly Brown at the Biltmore here and fell head over heels in love with the show, and Tammy Grimes, who I think I stalked for a while. And she will tell you that. And then I started going to everything that played the Huntington Hartford. So I saw the Tenth Man and Thurber Carnival, just every road show, you know, and I saw Oh Dad, Poor Dad at the Biltmore, and Stop the World, anything that came to town I saw.
Did you see any of the tryouts that ever came to Los Angeles, such as Love Match?
No. The only tryout I ever saw in L.A., and it's a play I want to do. I want to direct it. I want to show people how great it was called Time of the Barracuda.
Oh, yeah, Elaine Stritch was in it.
Which I told, when she did Drat the Cat, I told her I'd seen it and how great I thought it was. She was very tickled by that. And I quoted her dialogue because I never forget anything.
Oh, how funny. Yeah,
I quoted
that was
her, the Act One curtain line, and then her mouth hit the floor.
Isn't that something?
And
yeah,
it was by Peter Barnes. And I found a script to it at some shop here in L.A., and I can't find it anymore. I would love to do that play because it was about two people who were contract killers who killed their spouses for money, right? Professional killers who meet and marry each other and then spend the entire second act trying to kill each other.
I remember a friend of mine, the night that was opening out of town, saying, two, you can tell from the titles, these two shows that are opening out of town tonight are going to be such big flops, The Time of the Barracudas and Barefoot in the Park. You know, you can really tell just from the titles that both losers. Well, 50%
half right.
That's right, yeah.
Half right. But I think had Elaine not been having her issues, that might have gone somewhere. It was very dark. It probably was ahead of its time. Very, very black comedy. But Lawrence Harvey was wonderful in it. And she was wonderful. She was fantastic. Huge laugh. You know, I mean, it was really good.
Bruce, was the Angelina Jolie Brad Pitt movie Mr. and Mrs. Smith based on that?
You know, maybe I don't think so.
Is
maybe
that
you know,
right?
Maybe,
is that what the
you know,
plot
ideas
is?
Are a dime a dozen, but you know, it sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does sound like it. That it's fascinating. It's first I've heard of the show, so I have to check that out.
There are no new ideas.
Yeah, that's not.
And you know, I haven't seen that many flops even in New York. I was living there and somehow managed to miss The Fig Leaves Are Falling and La Strada and all these incredible things I should have seen and would love to have seen. You know, but they were expensive, $6.
Sure, sure. Who had the money? Absolutely true. No, it's true.
But I saw 1776.
Money well spent.
Yes.
So tell us how the genesis of the first nudie musical happened.
It happened because I lived in New York for that year. And like many out-of-work actors, I worked at a place called Commercial Analysts on 43rd on the east side, and it was a place where actors could, they took surveys, they called all over the country and took surveys, that was the job. And all these out-of-work actors worked there, and we used to love to go to what were nudie movies then. There was no porn, at least that you could go mainstream. So on 8th Avenue or on 42nd Street, you could go see The Lustful Turk, or She Came on the Bus, or and everything. And I thought it would be really funny to... Can you say that on a podcast? Okay. I thought it would be really funny to spoof those, and I used to say to everybody at the place, let's make a musical of this. A musical movie, we'll shoot it in 8mm, it'll all star us, and... We loved it, and somebody even did a poster for it, which I have. It's on the Blu-ray. And that was the genesis. And then when I moved back to L.A. in 1970, Cindy Williams, who I'd gone to school with, she had started, you know, getting work and had done Travels with My Aunt, and then The Conversation. So, and I had told her about this, and she thought it was really funny. And at that point, she said, I'm going to ask my friend Jack Nicholson to be the lead. And we were all going to use fake names. And somehow, over a four-year period, it evolved into the first Nudie musical. And we did it on the cheap. And it has survived.
It's amazing how... you can develop such a deep Rolodex, because your Rolodex probably goes deep into Hollywood as well as deep into the Broadway genre as well. I mean, you look at just the folks you have had on all the projects that you've worked on. Surely you've got some, at least one tale you can share with us. If you have to edit out some names, that's quite all right.
I could tell you a lot of tales. I recommend my books.
Okay.
There's Mel, there's Woody, and there's You, an album produced by, which have many, many tales, mm-hmm. probably some that I shouldn't have told. In fact, I had one ex. I met with one of my exes and said, you know, you're in the book, and I'm very nice to you, and I didn't have to be. And that ex was very upset with me.
Really?
Mm. Even though I was nice, she goes, but people will know we were together. I went, oh, well.
I know.
I think we were. I don't know if Susan Day is happy with me, you know, for talking about our little thing. But it was fun to talk about, and I'm always respectful, and I'm, you know, it's all for fun, and I don't, you know, dwell on it and go into detail. But, you know, I've had a lot of funny encounters. We'll call them. I haven't had too much negativity, you know, with people I've worked with. I call out the three people I didn't like in the film business in the first book. And I call out the people I didn't like in the second. If you've read Album Produced By, you know there's a villain in the book.
Yes, indeed.
And, you know, to me, somebody said, why did you have to name him? I go, because he was a cretin, you know, and he deserved it. He was a deceitful little prick.
Well, you know, you should really tell us how you feel about that. Don't hold back.
Exactly. But, you know, I've had funny, and, you know, you meet these wonderful, you know, I've developed really close friendships, like with Harvey Schmidt and Tony Walton, and, you know, that's been the biggest upside of this. You know, I can't say that Stephen Sondheim is my close friend, you know, because I don't think he has any, but... To work, you know, to at least get an email from him saying it's a miracle. You know, he doesn't quite know how to be effusive. He doesn't like effusive. Mm-hmm, when I sent him the liner notes, he said, they're too effusive for my tastes. And I said, tough. Mm-hmm. That was my response. How can you not be effusive?
Sure.
If you saw that production?
Sure.
Sorry. Doesn't work. And I was sending him all the comments as they came in, you know, thinking he would like them.
Yeah.
And, he took it for a while. And I sent him one too many, apparently. Because I guess I don't know that he likes the show, frankly. But he said, don't you think enough is enough? To which I responded, yes, enough is enough. But, you know, he said something. I went to see one of his chats out here recently. And I was backstage, and he was talking to a group of people backstage, and they said, what shows are you emotionally connected to? And, you know, it's always the same stuff, like Passion.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of all the shows, you know, that I'm not emotionally connected to, those are the ones he loves. Mm-hmm. And stuff like Folly, he said, well, that's not really personal to me. You know, that's not emotional to me.
Well, you know, they
I don't
say-
get it.
they say that's true of a lot of artists, that they have a soft spot for their least successful works.
Yeah, and I think he wrote them when he was older, and I think they move him to tears, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't see how you can listen to that score from Follies and not be moved to tears and not find it emotional. But he's very aloof about it. It's very weird to me. Although, that said, he was, you know, according to him, knocked out by the remix. So well, that's good.
Yeah.
So, Bruce, what can you tell us about that's coming up for you? Are you doing anything fun that you'd like to tell us about, or should we just stay tuned to Kritzerland.com?
There's so much stuff. I mean, we have so many great soundtracks coming up in over the next few months from Paramount and from Fox. And, you know, I am thinking about doing a test case with one of the Fox musicals to see how well we would do with it, because there's a lot of Fox musicals that have never seen the light of day. And, you know, I'm going to see if we can revisit these two capitals, and if we can, and if they come out really well, I'm going to revisit everything.
Wow.
Why not? You know what I mean? If you can make stuff that people have always thought sounded sort of not great, you know, like you, as you said, you know, when you listen to that compared to the other.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't think it's being sacrilegious with that kind of thing, especially because in those early days of stereo, they really were just having fun panning things over there and moving people around, you know, so that you think you're going to lose your sanity when you're listening to it.
Bruce, it would not be sacrilegious. It would be elevating them to sainthood. That's what it would be.
But, you know, again, I'm not sure how much is possible with those early ones.
Mm-hmm.
But I would love to give it a shot. I'd love to give Music Man a shot. My personal favorites of those.
Well, I think I may have sent you a wish list over the years, and actually maybe not too long ago, because as much as this project proves, you can greatly improve something that's very much available. But then there are still to this day things that were kind of major in their day that are you know, or that are not. There's the soundtrack of Porgy and Bess, which, it, you know, it sounds like it was beautifully recorded, but has never been commercially available on CD in this country.
No.
There's the soundtrack of Lil Abner, which is in, you know, sounds like it was, again, recorded in excellent sound, and then they just unfortunately decided to be a little gimmicky with the, you know, the placing the voices far left and far right.
Yeah,
so
I would do Little Abner in a heartbeat. It's my favorite show ever.
That's great.
But Sony has gone, you know, they own RCA and Sony,
mm-hmm,
now,
mm-hmm.
And they've gone down this very peculiar path, which nobody I know that loves shows understands, which is they're giving their gold to Archive. Who is doing CDRs with no tender loving care at all.
Oh, that's too bad.
And I hate it. You know, and you know, I've seen the sales figures. They won't like to know that, but I've seen the sales figures, and they're selling 80 copies. So wouldn't it be better to license to me and actually make some money? You know, we pay healthy advances on this stuff. It's not like I'm doing them for free.
Well, but, the problem... You know, in a case like that, it probably is difficult to even find out the person to talk to, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I have talked to Didier Deutsch about it, and
he
gets very fussy and protective, you know, and the minute I give him an idea, the next thing I know, it's on Archive, and so I'm not doing that anymore. If there's a way to talk to somebody else, I would certainly be willing to do it, but the one thing I would never, ever do that they seem to be very, although I got them off of it, and when I met, now that I think about it, with Subways or for sleeping and working, because I told them I would, in those days, but especially now, they have to do the mastering, and I won't let them because they don't do it well.
Yeah.
So I do remember getting the tapes of working and Subways. In fact, I got the multi-tracks at Subways. And so it's if they would allow me to do the mastering or remixing, if they would actually do what Capitol is doing and put the thing in Pro Tools and give me a chance to redo, you know, the one I would start with is 110 in the Shade, which is totally distorted. Mm-hmm. Whatever they did to that album master is horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think the multi-tracks are that way.
I didn't know that Didier Deutsch was still with us. He must be very, very advanced in years.
I think somebody said he was 80, 79.
Oh, really?
I would guess about that.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry. I must be mistaken. I was thinking he was much older. How much older?
You know, he is around and he's still in there. And but I don't understand the concept of archive. What is the gain other than making it available in sort of a half-assed way?
Right.
What is the gain for Sony?
Well,
I'd license
Bruce,
everything.
Forgive me if I'm totally wrong here, but I think that if something is not commercially available, don't they lose rights to it? Like anybody can step in and do it. So even if they're saying that they're making it available in a one-off situation and not making much money, they're retaining the rights to those things for possible future revenue. Isn't that correct?
They own all those shows outright. There's nothing they don't own. The soundtracks are a different story. I recently did Summer and Smoke.
But even if you own something outright, if you're an author and you write something and it's not published and not commercially available, somebody else can publish it and say, right under fair use, and say that this is not commercially available, so I can publish it.
Yeah, I don't know how that works.
I want to hear about Summer and Smoke. You were about to make a statement
about
it.
No, the thing was, you know, RCA had put out the album.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the session recording from Paramount, and it was not in good shape. It had a lot of wow and flutter, and we needed the RCA. And they ascertained, you know, RCA, of course, thinks they own everything forever in perpetuity, but Paramount found the paperwork, and they didn't own it. They did not own it after 1967. So it took almost 8 months for them to actually admit it and get us the tapes. They had the original four-track session tapes. Unbelievable. Perfect condition. So I would love to get in there, is the short answer to all of that, or the long answer. But I would love to get in there and have my way with certain RCA shows.
Bruce, do you ever run into degradation of the physical media, of, you know, tapes that just degrade and become dust?
Not so much. I would say the most problematic stuff we've had to deal with is from Paramount soundtracks, where there's a lot of wow and flutter to deal with. Usually we can get around it, you know, it doesn't involve everything, but it'll, you know, a track or two will have terrible things, and I'll find clever ways of editing around it. But, you know, but in terms of, like, stuff from, you know, ironically, the tapes from the 50s and the 60s are great. That was good tape. Get into the 70s and it's real crap. And so you have to bake tapes. They do what they call bake. You put them in an oven, literally put them in an oven and bake them. And then they're fine.
So was it a case that they were using cheaper tape or the technology had changed?
I don't know the reason. I think what happened was they transferred, at Paramount, was they would transfer everything onto 24-track 2-inch tapes. And either heads were bad or the tapes needed baking and they didn't know that in those days. And so the result is we're stuck with this now and they don't even have the other things anymore.
I mean, for example, I remember in the 70s, RCA records turned out to be much thinner than they used to be. The vinyl seemed to be more pliable to me. I wasn't sure if this was a good or a bad thing. Do you know whether it was or wasn't?
I think it cannot be a good thing when you can sway a record.
Yeah, huh.
You know what I mean? You can't take an RCA Victor record from 1958 and make it flop around.
Yeah, uh-huh.
You know, so I don't think... What did they call it? Didn't they have a name for that? That those 70s out with the orange?
Dynagroove?
Dynagroove is what I was thinking.
Something where you could literally just make it flopped in your hand.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
You could make it into a bonnet very easily. Yeah, yeah.
I remember the square 45s we'd get in the Sunday paper.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember those, yeah.
All right. Well, Bruce, we're coming up on an hour, and we meant to talk to you for about 10 minutes. And
but you were too interesting.
Really, really, really appreciate you coming on and talking about this. And when your next projects get lined up and you're able to tell us about those, I'd love it if you come back and talk with us again.
I will.
Great. Excellent. So, Bruce, thanks so much, and we will talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye, Bruce. Bye.
All right, so we went much longer than we intended to with Bruce, but it was a great discussion, so we didn't want to cut it off. But what we'll do is we'll return to our discussions of Broadway theater and the news that's surrounding the Broadway community next week. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Good evening.
Night.
Bye. After the curtain came down, money in my pocket to spend. Honey, could you maybe get a friend for my friend? Hearing the sound of the girls above, dressing to go on the town. Clicking heels on steel and cement, picking up the giggles floating down through the vent. Goddamnedest hours that I ever spent. We're waiting for the girls upstairs.